Pacifica Radio in San Francisco. This is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, fighting for the freedom of WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange. We'll be joined by Gabriel Shipton, Julian's brother, and Julian's dad, John Shipton. Also joining the discussion is staunch Assange defender Randy Critico. And we'll feature excerpts of an exclusive interview Randy and I did with Julian before he was brutalized and violently arrested in Great Britain. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're having some technical difficulty, but I think we're doing okay. Mike, send me a message, and I can continue to play with the dials here. In any event, this is Flashpoints, your daily investigative news magazine. We broadcast every weekday from the San Francisco Bay Area from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network. That's KPFA in the Bay Area. And joining us for this special on Julian Assange is his brother, Gabriel, and his dad, John Shipton, Gabriel Shipton and John Shipton. And also joining us, as I said, is Randy Critico. A little bit later on, it's sort of a family affair. You can hear from some sound from Julian that Randy and I did a part of his series coming out of New York City. Again, welcome to Flashpoints, John, and welcome Julian's brother, Gabriel. How are you doing today?
Yeah, we're doing very well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, good to have you with us. And let's start with you, Dad. What is the prime? Congratulations, you've had quite a tour. Julian has been recognized by various institutions. Tell us about the motivation for the tour at this time and some of the things that have happened along the way for you.
Is that for me? Okay.
That's for Dad.
Gabriel and I. That's for you. That's John here. We did a few tours in Australia, in fact, four, and we worked out, and we came to the United States in January in an attempt to see members of the Biden administration. They communicated to us that, you know, they'd better to come back after the inauguration. So the experience of the tours in Australia taught us the value of going to see people and just mixing with regional media and bringing together people in groups that could discuss amongst themselves and assist us by writing to parliamentarians. And that worked really well in Australia, so we thought, well, we'll have a go in the United States. And naturally, the United States is where the decisions are made regarding Japan.
And Gabriel, do you want to jump in here?
Yeah, I can start it off.
And respond to the Miami, sort of the input. Go on. You can continue. Sorry, we're having some technical problems.
Okay, we've got a bit of a delay on the call, I think. Do you want to go ask your question?
I guess, Gabriel, why don't you talk a little bit about the motivation, and let's see if we can get a bit of sound on you as we do this. But you tell us a bit about the motivational force and a little bit about what this means to you to have your brother facing this kind of situation.
I guess the motivation to come over here and do this is, this is where the place where the decisions are made in Julian's prosecution. So this is where the prosecution, originates. And so that's why we're here, to sort of take action where the prosecution originates. My motivation, I'd come and join this worldwide campaign later. I only sort of joined in 2019 after I saw Julian in Belmarsh prison. At that point he was on suicide watch. He was in the health wing of the prison, and that sort of, you know, just sort of after that visit, I thought, if I don't get out and do something, then I might never see my brother again. So that sort of launched me on this to join this worldwide campaign, which is, just growing and growing every day. I mean, as we move across the country, there are more and more people coming out to find out about Julian's case, what he's being prosecuted for, and come and see us, tell us they're supportive. And yeah, it's been really encouraging. I think in New York we had to expand the venue three times. We had to add more tickets in DC. We had a packed house. One of the videos from our New York event with Roger Waters has gone completely viral, and it's it's over a million hits on online. So it's just encouraging to see how much interest there is in Julian's case here.
And say a little bit more about, I'd like you to talk a little bit more about your brother and what it was like growing up. And was it expected that he would go down this path, become an internationally renowned publisher, editor, writer? What were the early clues?
Julian was, I got to know Julian probably better in my late teens, because we have an age difference, 10 or so years. I'm quite a bit younger. He was always involved in, just standing up for people who are suffering injustice, basically, and trying to figure out ways how to right injustice. One of the early things that he was involved in was a cryptography program called Rubber Hose Cryptography, which was in year 2000, around that period. So it was very early days for encryption, and he devised this piece of software that a journalist could use and be able to keep information secret even if they were being tortured. And how it worked is it was a piece of encryption software that had multiple layers. So if say you would pulled over at a border or arrested and your USB stick was confiscated and you were being tortured, you could give up one password, and that would give your torturers access to just one layer of the encryption. And in that layer, there might be something that, would satisfy them and they would stop torturing you, but the secondary layer would remain encrypted and invisible. Which is where you would put the information that you did not want them to find. So, protecting sources and things like that. So, from a very early early on, Julian was interested in this sort of field of journalism, cryptography, how to sort of you know, protect journalists, protect people, and fight injustice.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with John and Gabriel Shipton. They are brother and dad and brother of Julian Assange. They're on a tour of the United States, calling attention, trying to do everything they can to manifest the force to free Julian Assange from jail. Also joining us is a good friend, Randy Credico, whose programming on Julian Assange has been crucial in calling attention in this country and around the world to what's been happening with Assange. Randy Credico, welcome back to Flashpoints. Good to have you with us.
It's, you know, really, so far I love this. You got two outstanding individuals on. And Dennis, I want to just start by saying there was a time in 2017, I know you're going to play a little pastiche from it, of my last interview and your last interview with Julian, just prior to him being mothballed by the Linda Moreno administration a few months later. But the fact is that when that ended in 2000, when I left the AI and you picked up the slack here at KPFA for the next ensuing 2 years, we did another 25 shows together. So this station and Flashpoints has really played a critical part. I mean, interviews with Julian, interviews with Thomas Drake, interviews with John Pilger and Stefano Morici, and just about anyone that matters. You picked up the slack on it, and so I really appreciate that. And I want to say that that. Just looking at this right now, at where we are with the Assange case, it is so critical. You know, if something happens to him, and both you and I, Dennis, have been involved in all political cases in this country. You have longer than I have because you've been a journalist and I've been a comedian. But going Leonard Peltier, Mumia, there are all of these political cases out there, political prisoners. But we realize, you know, we stop and say, if we don't have a free press, and that's what's happening with Julian Assange, if he is neutralized, and then what happens next? You know, KPFA, WBAI, how are we going to talk about Leonard Peltier? How are we going to talk about Mumia and the tens of thousands of other people who are in prison languishing under this racist criminal justice system if we don't have a free press? Julian, is if he goes, that's why I'm so focused on it and have been anally, because it represents everything that could possibly happen to free speech in this country if he is brought to this country and put in prison. We're all done. This is the most critical case, political case in the country at this point, maybe the world.
I agree with you, and I want to do this, Randy, in the tradition of the shows, the many shows we did together. You've been following this tour closer than I have. I want to turn the mic over to you for a bit and let you question our guests from your knowledge.
All right, well, look, I will say this, Dennis. They're going to be in your city in San Francisco. We have, you know, you've been on this
a week from tomorrow. A week from tomorrow, that is.
Yes, and you've been on this for many years from the outset. There are a lot of people that, like, because they fell for the disinformation, the smear jobs, all of that stuff that went on Julian. Whether it be that bogus, the sexual allegations, his connection with the Trump campaign, all of that stuff meant to smear him, besmirch his character, all of that stuff. You were there and you realized it from the beginning what it was, because you're aware of what governments do, and this government in particular does, to quell dissent. And there were people that, even at your station, even at your station and at my station at WBAI, that fell for it, that actually fell for the disinformation and the smear campaign. But now that has been neutralized the smear campaign. We realized it was all lies, it was all garbage, and everyone's coming together right now. It's not too late. And these gentlemen here, let me ask you, Gabriel, what it was like for you to you know, view the lies and the smears about your brother. How did you get? How did that affect you personally?
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, it's been going on for years and years and years, really. I mean, you know, like almost 12 years, and I think, you know, what was always very obvious to me is this all started after Julian published, you know, the Afghan war logs, the Iraq war logs, the Guantanamo detainee files, all these, you know, amazing publications that he partnered with, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Guardian, the Spiegel, all these media institutions around the world in publishing, you know, all these negative news stories, all these smears, all this mobbing, it all started after Julian exposed the corruption and lies that, you know, the U.S. government has been telling the people. So for a very long time, it's been obvious to me, you know, what's been going on. You know, this is from the playbook. You attack someone's personality, you give them that big factor, and then you go after them, you know, through the courts. So yes. I think, you know, it's just obvious. I mean, I've obviously had, you know, I have friends who fall for it, and you know, it's just always working to explain what this is actually about. You know, this is about Julian publishing and exposing lies and corruption of the people that we our elected officials.
And John, let me ask you, your son is being treated like a criminal. I mean, he's a hero to so many people. How does it affect you as a father to see your son being treated like a criminal, like he did something wrong? What is your response? How did you feel when this first took place?
Well, you know, there's a funny response in the sense of irony. The harder they go at your kids, the stronger you become. When they push your children to the wall, then you become very strong and determined to fight until, well, not being overly dramatic, fight until you drop. That's the circumstance that arises in the breast when they attack your kids. That's how I felt all the way through. Given the opportunity and the timing, the resources that I would embark upon. Well, you and I worked together on this, and Gabrielle and many, many other, probably about 100,000 people worldwide. Somebody reported to me and sent me some statistics on Facebook and saying that there had been about 30 million people visiting in one way or another, inquiry or information about the prosecution of Julian Assange and the deluge of malice that the Swedish Prosecution Authority, the Crown Prosecuting Service, and the Department of Justice and their executives have delivered to Julian over this 12 years.
Yeah, it's just amazing that it's been 12 years. Your son is an anti-war activist. I mean, you know, that he exposes crimes by the government, whether they be war crimes, torture, mass surveillance, you name it. That's all he does. He's just a reporter, and it must be so bizarre, Kafka-esque, and I don't even like to use that term because he knows why he's being tried, because he exposed all of that. But the fact that he is in this position, and you know, it's unique for you too to see it, because this doesn't happen every day to somebody's kid. Our brother Gabriel, you must have been shocked when these charges were first brought up against your brother?
I think we sort of knew there was an underlying a secret indictment for quite a while. So I guess we knew it was coming, and Julian, was adamant that all the time, these last 11 years, is that this would be the eventuality, that this is where the charges would originate from. The DOJ was pushing, was just sort of biding its time and standing, and had this, open prosecution just waiting to go. So I think, we weren't sort of, I don't think I was surprised in that way. I think we sort of, expected that it would come to this. But, I think it's just what is surprising is that it's actually still going, it's still moving forward. We expected after Obama under Eric Holder, they had the New York Times problem. Obama commuted Chelsea Manning's sentence. So we sort of thought that, under Biden, that this would we would just revert back to the Obama administration. So what is surprising is that it's continuing under the new administration. I find that quite surprising.
Let me jump in here, Randy. Let people know you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with John and Gabriel Shipton. That's the father and brother of award-winning Australian journalist Julian Assange. They're on a nationwide tour. They'll be here in the Bay Area. For those of you who are listening locally, they'll be here a week from tomorrow. They'll be joined by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Alice Walker and legendary whistleblower Dan Ellsberg. Both of those folks are deep and strong supporters. We'll be among other luminaries as well. We'll give you the information as we move closer to the date. I also want to let you know that this national tour that they're on is meant to bring awareness of the importance of protecting whistleblowers and journalists. That's all of us. They are calling on the U.S. government to drop its prosecution and finally let Julian go home. And let me ask you this, John and Gabriel, what goes through your mind? Is there a certain fury, anger, rage at the fact that so many journalists and news organizations that benefited from, that utilized, that respected, I say respected Julian's work in the sense that they used it thoroughly, and now when the stuff hits the fan, everybody's sort of quiet. All those noisy journalists are quiet. Randy tried to raise this at a meeting a year or two ago with journalists, and he got dragged out of the room. What are your thoughts on that, John?
Well, that was very disappointing, particularly as this is an important point, particularly ignoring the prosecution of Julian Assange endangers the entirety of the press corps Western worldwide because of the oppression and intimidation. Equally, publishers and publications are constrained because no publisher or publication wants to face the fact that you have to have lawyers in five jurisdictions to defend a journalist and have a journalist in jail after detention for year on year on year, and for the publication and for that journalist mob, sneeze and so on. So I was very shocked that they didn't realize that this is a circumstance that was going to come down on them. Once the prestige of journalists is lowered, as we can see now, that enables governments to move against them. If they hold their prestige up and if they have some sort of unity, then the government thinks well, certain sections of the government think twice about attacking them. I want to make the point very strongly here that every journalist association in the Western world has come out in support of Julian vigorously and firmly. That that journalists in association with their employers and publishers haven't over the time was disappointing. However, the Washington Post and the Guardian and the New York Times had editorials advocating that this prosecution not go ahead. The circumstances and the realization that it's the intimidation and the oppression of publication and journalists is universal to the Western world, and it's a problem that they ought to attend to as quickly and as firmly as possible.
Gabe, you want to take a shot at that?
Sorry, what was that?
Would you take a shot at that? Are you concerned, bothered, outraged that some of the journalists who built and expanded their reputations, winning awards based on material that Julian Assange made available, or have now turned their backs?
It's a tough one, and I think they are sort of coming around, and they're coming around, slowly, and we have to, really support them to be able to do more reporting, and that's why, doing shows like this and doing this tour and all these sort of things encourages them to, get involved more on this on this issue. So that's the sort of way I look at it, is that, they need support to be able to do this, and that comes from independent media, and it comes from the people voicing their concerns, that they're interested in this subject and they want these people to report on it. As John was saying, he's seen executive editors at the Washington Post and the New York Times voicing their concern that the prosecution of Julian is, it's an attack on press freedoms and First Amendment in the United States. And 24 organizations wrote a letter to the DOJ in February, which was reported on in the New York Times. On World Press Freedom Day, Jen Psaki was asked a question about Julian Assange. So we are seeing slowly, we're getting this back into the mainstream media, and I think that's really important, that we sort of keep pushing them, keep trying to support them to really make this an issue for them, because it matters to them. It's their First Amendment too. It's the whole country's First Amendment, and it needs to be defended. Otherwise, it'll just disappear.
Can I jump in, Dennis? Here for
yes,
a
please go on, Randy.
I understand the diplomacy here, but the mainstream media has not, they circled the firing squad rather than the wagons hitherto for Julian. And I see some of them, breaking away a little bit. And the senior editors at the New York Times and the Washington Post, and Margaret Sullivan in particular at the Washington Post, have come out and realize that this affects everybody. It affects all of them, except for somebody said, look, these guys will survive. Guys like Jim Sciotto and his twin brother, Jim Acosta, they may be the same person. I don't know. They'll survive this because, that's what they do. They play, do the company business, Operation Mockingbird. But there are a lot of people out there that are, not afraid to go into the water. They're getting a little better on this because they realize it will have blowback on them if they don't, stand solidly behind Julian Assange. I mean, as John Pilger said, he has shamed a lot of journalists by exposing, you know, what happened to those Reuters reporters and all those children, you know, the mass surveillance that we saw in Vault 7, that these people should have been on top of. Instead of wasting their time with Russiagate, they should have been on top of this, because it affects all of us. And Julian, even in the most difficult circumstances, put out Vault 7 while he was ensconced in that embassy. He still had the courage and the guts and the integrity to put that stuff out there. And that's what a journalist is supposed to do. We're all better. We are all informed because of Julian Assange. And I really feel bad for these people who call themselves journalists that have not circled the wagons around him. And so I know it's diplomatic to say that they're going to come around. Some of them haven't come around yet, and I think that some of them will. This is a great contribution. This is going after Beethoven. This is going after Tolstoy. This is going after Einstein of journalism. That's Julian Assange. What he has done is unprecedented in the history of journalism. No one's done what.
and also the awards that he should have been given, but were given to all the people who used his material, who turned their back on him. You know, I mean, this is the deep work of deep journalism. By the way, let me interrupt, Randy, because I need to do another part of this job, which is to let people know again that we will have the guest of John and Gabriel Shipton in the Bay Area in San Francisco. That is going to be happening next Saturday. That's June 26th, next week, 2 p.m. They're going to be at the Islamic Cultural Center of Northern California. For those of you who are listening to this show in the Bay Area, this is a week from tomorrow. Pulitzer Prize winning writer Alice Walker is going to be there, one of my favorite people. Pentagon's paper defendant William Daniel Ellsberg is going to be there. I think they're going to be piping in Noam Chomsky from another location, and as well as Mumia Abu-Jamal. There'll be all kinds of interesting things, interesting people there. I will be there. Jeff Mackler will be there. Many, many others. And we're hoping, John and Gabriel are hoping that as many people as possible turn out. You're hoping for the best, aren't you? You'd like to see hundreds, if not thousands, there. Yes, John?
Yes, but just to add to Randy's comment about the press in general, of course, it's appalling, the abandonment of Julian. Of course, it's disgraceful. Of course, it's shameful. All of those things. However, the way to redemption is wide open. And that's why we say that realizing their self-interest is the way to redemption. And the redemption is the freedom of their colleague and compatriot, Julian Assange. That's in a nutshell.
Well, he's much more diplomatic than I am. You know, I agree with you, John, totally. And we hope that these people do redeem themselves. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to butt in. Dennis. Dennis, where is that location at the Islamic Center in San Francisco? There's also one in Oakland. Can you give us the address of that one?
This is happening in Oakland. Thank you for pointing that out. It's the Islamic Cultural Center of Northern California. That's 1433 Madison Street in Oakland. It's in Oakland, not in San Francisco. Again, it's the Islamic Cultural Center of Northern California, 1433 Madison Street in Oakland. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. What we're going to do is we're going to take a short musical.
Dennis, yes. There's one in San Francisco also the following day, right?
Okay, I don't have that information in front of me, but before this show is over, we're going to find that out. Please let me take a musical break. When we come back, we're going to talk some more. And then we're going to hear a little bit of Julian, because we are remembering him, and nobody can remind us who Julian Assange is better than Julian Assange. So short musical break. We'll be right back. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We apologize to the listeners. We're having a particularly difficult time today in terms of a few technical bugs we're trying to work out. But obviously the content and the essence is what is most important here. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We are joined by Gabriel and John Shipton. Gabriel is Julian's brother and John is his dad. We're talking about their tour, which is going to, I understand, I guess, get us into Oakland and San Francisco. And we're going to find that out before we get off the air, what's going on. Mike, maybe you can just do a little Google search or something and see if we can find out where this is happening in San Francisco. Randy, I want you to do a very quick introduction of the clip. We're going to play about 8 minutes of the interview that you did, that I joined you for, with Julian. I think it's very powerful and timely because it gets into Putin and Oliver Stone's visit, and Julian sort of analyzing Putin through the visit of Oliver Stone. Very interesting. You learn a lot. You can see a lot about who Julian is. But say a little bit more about that.
Dennis, it started, this is July 25th. It was the end of the Assange Countdown to Freedom series at WBAI. It was like a 20-part series. You were involved in the last five. So Julian said, I want to do the show on the 25th. He called me up on the 24th and said, and I want Dennis to do it too. So we had it, as many people as possible listening. And it was with him and his partner, by the way. The whole hour was with him and right. his partner, Stella Morris. And so you and I did it. You were in San Francisco. I was in New York. And we interviewed him live. And it was you realize how clear, how intelligent, how cogent and brilliant this individual is that they're trying to snuff out on all levels right now. He listened to him, and he got a sense of humor. And we talked about the recent summit between Trump and Putin and Oliver Stone and all of that. And so we go into that. You and I went back and forth with questions for 35, 40 minutes, and then we went into his partner. So this is a little pastiche.
And that interview is available, but this interview starts with you asking Julian about releases having to do with things in the United States, the gunning down at Kent State for students. And let's pick it up now.
All right, Julian, I just want to make a couple of observations first, and that is this woman called me last night. Her name is Laura Krauss. She's a sister of Alison Krauss, who was the... In the heart of the hell, show love, wants to know your name. Love wants to know your name. Know your name. Love wants to know your name.
go-getter. Here now.
I was in California, and I had an idea for an album of doing like all this New Orleans gree-gree music and preserving something that I thought was kind of disappearing in New Orleans. And I wanted to do it for a label called White Whales Records that the Turtles and Nino Tempo and April Stevens was recording for. And they turned the idea down. And so I got an attitude. And I figured, well, look, if Sonny Bono is singing, Bob Dylan is singing, I could do this. I don't know nothing about singing or nothing, but I figured if they doing it, I'll do it. And I did it. But I figured it was a one-off deal. Who would have thunk that 30-something years later that I'd still be doing this? I shouldn't think it.
They call me Dr. John, known as a nitrous. The queen of the little red, white, and blue. She was the queen of the little.
All right. Now I want to introduce Dennis Bernstein, who's coming from KPFA. Dennis?
Thank you, Julian Assange. Terrific to meet you on the phone. I got all the dope on you from the best source, which is your mom, who we spoke to a couple of weeks ago, and she was crucial and strong. It's good to meet you here on the phone. By the way, I just got off the line with Oliver Stone, who was being shredded everywhere because he had the temerity and the nerve to do a series of interviews with Putin. And all the idiot journalists in the corporate media of the United States are falling over each other to show how tough they are by putting down Oliver Stone. By the way, what'd you think of those? Have you had a chance to hear any of that stuff?
I did see all four. I think they're very interesting. You can split them up into the first three and the last one, because the last one happens after the US elections. So it takes place within the context of this neo-McCarthyist Russian hysteria. And so it's a bit more combative. Also, I guess it's the last in the series, and so therefore Stone doesn't have to play so nice to make sure he gets the next episode. But I think in terms of the aesthetics are quite interesting. He uses, you know, four or five shaky cameras, which I like. But it's just, you know, Putin is a consummate politician for Russia, little less consummate when dealing with the rest of the world, but still pretty skilled. But you can't hide completely who you are over the course of 4 hours. So lots of little interesting things come out.
Like, name one. Curious.
Well, I'll give you an example. It has been remarked upon, but not many people have seen it. So not many people have detected it. I think it's in the last or second last episode. Oliver Stone is showing Vladimir Putin, Dr. Strangelove,
yes,
which Putin says he hasn't seen before, which is actually quite possible. And Dr. Strangelove is one of my favorite movies. I think it's Stanley Kubrick, I think, at his best, actually, in terms of aesthetics plus deep political insights into, in that case, nuclear war. So Putin is completely unmoving during the whole thing. And you can understand why. As a Russian leader, he needs to not display weakness at any point in time. And I assume that Kubrick's movie is, from Putin's point of view, he doesn't know, if he genuinely doesn't know what the movie is, he doesn't know how it's going to end. And so therefore, anything that he does partway through, any smiling, for example, or laughing at a particular scene, he doesn't know how that character or that scene's going to pan out. And so he has to keep himself kind of resolute to being affected by the film. And at the end of the film, he says, well, that's interesting. They even predicted some of the technical issues, and actually not much has changed in the basic dynamics, which is, you know, basic mad dynamics. And he's fiddling with a DVD case of the film. And Oliver Stone gives him the case, and he walks out the door to say goodbye to go into another chamber of the Kremlin. And then he comes back with a little, you know, very subtle smirk on his face, with the CD case open and presented to Stone in the camera, rotating it around a bit. And you can see that it's empty. And he says, well, typical American gift.
That's what we have at WBAA, by the way. We have typical gifts. That's going to be our premium tonight. A nice documentary by Oliver Stone with an empty inside.
We'll give the case an empty inside.
Typical American gift.
$60.
But here's the twist. That's what quite a lot of people remarked on that. It is actually pretty funny. And from the Russian perspective, actually, in the post-90s, they made many of these overtures. You could say they're in a forced position, but they did. And then they felt the U.S. didn't live up to its side of the bargain. So empty gift box.
Empty promises from the Americas.
Exactly. If you look very closely, you'll see that when Putin is fiddling with the DVD case, while he's talking about the movie, while it's on the table, before Oliver Stone has given it to him, he cracks it open just a little bit and peers inside for half a second, not even, quarter of a second, and closes it again. So actually, he knows when Putin has given it to him, when Oliver Stone has given it to him, that it's empty. And so then he's clearly thinking about the political dynamics of this gag as he's going into the other room. Because what's the other interpretation? The other interpretation is Putin is such a neurotic paranoid that when Oliver Stone gives him a DVD case, the first thing he does is not like
a bomb.
Go off and do useful work. He neurotically opens it and checks it to see, is there really a DVD in there, or maybe a bug or something else.
And you are listening to Flashpoints. That was Julian Assange speaking with Randy Credico and myself, Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Randy along with John and Gabriel Shipton. That's the father and brother of the award-winning Australian journalist Julian Assange. And they're on a national tour to free Julian from jail. I have to ask you, I don't know, either John or Gabriel or both, how is Julian doing physically? There are some real questions here and real dangers. Who wants to take that? Please identify and then give us some information about that, please. John,
Gabriel.
Gabriel,
go ahead. He's in his third year of prison, and in the maximum security prison at Belmarsh. He's not really, he's not doing the best. He's been, Nils Melzer has found that he'd been, psychologically tortured. And Nils Melzer had two doctors that went to see Julian to get a sort of medical assessment, an independent medical assessment. And then those doctors found that Julian was suffering the effects of psychological torture. I think that, what we're seeing is like a slow motion, a sort of murder in slow motion of Julian Assange. And, if he's not freed from that prison, he will die, either in that prison at Belmarsh or in the U.S. if he's ever extradited. So that's the predicament that we're in, and that's why it's so, as a family, that's why we're all so focused on getting him out, because we don't want to lose a brother or son, or he has to children as well. So you're all just, you know, so focused on and united to, you know, free him from that prison.
And Randy, why don't you jump in here and talk a little bit more about that? I'm going to get some information about the appearances, but let's keep talking about that a little. Maybe Dad has something to say on it as well. We want to keep that health thing front and center.
Let me just say this. I got to see him the last time, November 13th of 2017, and he was clear. He was funny. He was sharp. And then I saw him. This is where I met both John and Gabriel on February 24th at Balmores. The first half of the, you know, they say Kafkaesque. I don't think it's Kafkaesque. He knows why he's being tried. But the farce, the show trial, that the first half was in Balmores. I went to that and I met these two gentlemen. I sat next to them. I got to see the restrained anguish on their face, looking down from the second floor through a plexiglass bulletproof window into the well where he was, like in the dock in a enclosed bulletproof glass enclosure. And I'm seeing this. I said, where have I seen this before? It was when Eichmann was tried in 1960, he was in the same situation in a glass bulletproof enclosure, but he had access to his lawyers, and he wasn't strip searched, and he wasn't beaten up back and forth to his, his jail cell as Julian was. Julian had no access to his lawyers. He was sitting in this area, and this is a guy who exposed war crimes, exposed torture. You know, Eichmann committed all of that. He committed the genocide. Julian exposed people like Eichmann, and he's in the same kind of box without the same kind of perks as Eichmann. So I took photos. I broke the law in England. I admit it because I don't want somebody else to go to jail for it. If I go back to London, I will be arrested. But to see John and Gabriel looking down, the brother and the father of Julian Assange, in this horrible situation, for what? The guy has not done anything but, like, the best things in life. I would want to have a kid that is like Julian Assange. And so I don't know where this is in San Francisco, but when you tell us, Dennis, where it is, I want everybody in San Francisco to please show up at this event. I'm going to try to get out there. I don't know if I'm going to be able to.
And I want to be clear, Randy. I'm sorry, Randy. I'm sorry to interrupt, but the only information I have, I don't know what you have, is I know for sure of the event that's happening in Oakland. If there's more information, I will put it up on my website. You'll put it up on your website. But right now, the information I have is that there will be an event. It will take place Saturday at 2 p.m. At the Islamic Cultural Center of Northern California in Oakland. The address is 1433 Madison Street. And I'm sure those of you listening to this show can Google and make sure that that is the one and only.
June 27th in San Francisco. That's what I have. June 27th, but it is to be announced where it is. So maybe Gabriel or John can tell us if they know. If not, I'll be back on your show to deliver that information.
Okay. We'll figure that out because we have a week. Anyway, I want to give final comments to Dad. Do you want to talk about, once again, remind people of the urgency for action in support of finally releasing Julian Assange from jail and letting him do the work he was born to do? Mr. Assange?
We move into the third year of this persecution, this deluge of malice that Julian's been delivered to Julian, and Randy described the show trial and the first hearing. The second hearing was even more extraordinary. It was characterized by the great diarist Craig Murray as the Eptman of evil. So the circumstances were that Julian was again in the glass box. He had to get on his knees and slot in the glass into the ear of the instructing solicitor, who was standing on their tiptoes, and the whispering could be overheard by the prosecution. That's appalling circumstance. The defense asked that Julian be allowed to move into the well of the court, but the judge said, oh no, that will require a bail application. That's simply wrong. But besides that, she decided that Julian had to stay in those circumstances continually for the 3 weeks of the hearing. So another circumstance arose in El Masri, the difficulty of El Masri giving his evidence. El Masri is a torture victim who, in the hands of the CIA, was immediately sodomized. Over a period of time, with the help of the files released by WikiLeaks, El Masri was released and began to sue the German government and the US government. However, it had to be dropped. But his testimony was about to be refused by the judge and by the prosecutor through a sleight of hand. The defense counsel said nothing, and Julian, you know, may God protect him and preserve him. Julian got up at his own risk and said, I will not have this court quash or censor the evidence of the torture.
All right, we're out of time. We're losing you now. Sorry for the technical problems, but the information is strong and clear. I want to thank my guests, John and Gabriel Shipton, father and brother of award-winning journalist Julian Assange, Randy Credico, live on the fly coming out of WBAI in New York, doing incredible reporting over a number of years to call attention to his friend's persecution. We're talking about Julian Assange. Thanks to everybody. More to come. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Any thoughts about cancel culture? Chris Hedges says the liberal proponents of cancel culture have become the grand inquisitors of speech. In his new book, Cancel This Book, labor lawyer Dan Kovalik argues that cancel culture is mean-spirited, a danger to any progressive movement, that it serves only the interests of the extremely powerful. In Cancel This Book, Kovalik argues for a total end to cancel culture and a renewed focus on solidarity, on compassion and civility. Mickey Huff of Project Censored will interview Kovalik in a Zoom event Tuesday, July 13th. For the Eventbrite link, just go to the KPFA website and scroll down the front page.
You're listening to 94.1 KPFA, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online worldwide at kpfa.org.